sort of vedana, the feeling form, possible, it's permissible to also translate vedana as how we feel about things. As long as how we feel about things is just really basic. We like it or we don't like it. Or we neither like it nor not like it. Pleasant, unpleasant. Because pleasant and unpleasant sometimes seems to stand by itself. But often it seems to be entangled with liking and not liking and other things. And so learning to be free has a lot to do with also learning how to be free when pleasant and unpleasant, comfortable and uncomfortable. Free when things go the way we want them, or when things don't go the way we want them. So I'm curious about when you went for your walk in 20 minutes, what did you learn? What did you see about yourself in terms of pleasant and unpleasant? What was its reaction and response?
I walked around the block and ended up on El Camino, and the roar of the traffic was very unpleasant. And so my first impulse was, let me get out of here. I need to get away from it. And then I thought, that's what I'm expected to feel. So I decided, so what? It's traffic. It's El Camino. And then at the same time, I was thinking how gorgeous the day was. And the little green guy, the sky looked like it was different. And so I thought, am I clinging to this? And, but yeah, sure. I want to use my book. But it was really easy to let go after, you know, sitting all morning. It was really easy not to take and give it anyway, really.
And when things are unpleasant, this idea of wanting to get away from it, is that a common strategy of yours?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Get me out of here.
Mary has a mic, so...
It was a very interesting experience for me. I didn't feel that much pleasant and unpleasant. I had a lot of thoughts, and I kept noticing myself looking for whether it felt pleasant or unpleasant. And I felt like I was trying to create pleasant and unpleasant in a lot of cases where I'm really neutral. And I'm starting to think that a lot of this pleasant, unpleasant, like and dislike, I mean, I guess I already learned, it's really conditioned. And how at one time I lived my life always looking for what I liked and trying to get away from what I didn't like. And but at some point before that, there was a lot more neutrality. So it was interesting just to see that I'm looking for pleasant and unpleasant. And I didn't always find it.
Interesting. So a couple of things I wonder, listening to that. One is there a confusion for you between liking and pleasant, unliking and unpleasant? Because, as I said, it's kind of a gray area between them. There's two in this stuff.
You mean, am I confused?
So in other words, you might be very little preference for someone. But lack of preference, you can't say that means that nothing, things are not pleasant to anybody.
It's possible. But in the actually trying to check out my experience, I didn't have a lot of dislike.
Very interesting. The theory of Buddhist psychology, so that way, is that the neutral experiences are extremely rare. Neutral experiences. So the fact that most of your experience in the 20 minutes is neutral, from the point of view of the theory, at least, seems a little odd.
And when I'm sitting, that's not my experience. When I'm sitting, there's a lot of pleasant and unpleasant. Lately more unpleasant than pleasant. So maybe there's something pleasant for me about walking that I'm interpreting as neutral.
Could be.
Because it's a more comfortable walking.
Could be. I know there's some people who will not interpret or take things in as being pleasant or unpleasant because it doesn't relate to anything that has any value to it. And as long as they're always looking at, you know, what's in it for me, or what's valuable for me, or what's the common threat for me, or something, then they see things as pleasant and unpleasant, and then it doesn't relate, then, you know.
So that's not neutral, though, necessarily. If it doesn't relate, that's not necessarily neutral?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of subjective evaluations going into them, because I really think they're pleasant and unpleasant. And I think that going out there going out and feeling the warmth against your skin could be pleasant. Or if the sun is really bright, the sharp light is unpleasant.
It is. It's not warm or cold, and the sun's not too bright.
Uh-huh.
So I hate the bright sun. To me, it seemed neutral. I'm pretty sensitive to the environment, and usually I'm complaining about it. And I didn't have any of those.
I think it was last month or sometime yesterday. I mentioned this woman who came on the retreat. And he came to the teacher and said, "Something really strange is happening to me. I'm not sure what it is." And then I think it's very happened to me before. The teacher said, "Oh, go back and look more carefully." So she came back 2 days later to an interview and said to the teacher, "I discovered what it is. I'm calm." And I've never been calm before. It was so new. It was like I didn't know what it was. So I find myself very curious about what you're reporting. And so I appreciate and thank you for what you're saying. And my curiosity wants to encourage you to go back out there. and it's kind of explore what the phenomenon is, what's going on. And it probably is more to discover in the process.
Yeah, I'm curious now, too.
So, up here in the front, Kenya, I think.
I think it goes in the same direction. It's not pleasant and pleasant liking, not liking. Because I keep wondering when I keep asking myself, so is pleasant really liking, or is unpleasant really not liking? And I realize it's not. Because I sometimes feel unpleasant, whatever, and I like it. Because I'm so used to it, and I'm so, I have so much comfort experiencing it. So it's really bizarre that I like it. And there are things I feel they are pleasant, like within the sort of tunnel. That helps me today, because right now I feel calm, but I just like it. Or those are the same here. So that's what I was thinking about when I started. I was wondering.
Yes, there's a subjective evaluation of the situation. Colors, different shapes, the pleasant and unpleasant. There's layers of evaluation that goes on. So I can imagine someone, growing up in a very dreary place. And it's basically a pleasant place. But then they go away for 10 years and they come back, and all their childhood memories and everything is there. It's so comforting to be back in the home place. It feels pleasant to be back in the dreariness, but it's so comforting. And there's layers and layers like that can happen. Associations with the effect evaluation of pleasant and unpleasant. And so, regardless of where we are in the levels of evaluation, whether we're really close to the actual inherent experience, without any evaluation at all, or whether there's many layers of evaluation that goes into the pleasant and unpleasantness, that's often where we're reacting. We're reacting to the fact that we see it or evaluate it as pleasant or unpleasant. Whether it is enough, whether it is really enough, it's almost irrelevant. That's where we're caught. Okay.
I found the walking very intense, sensory, like everything seemed more intense, colors, light, and I felt I just find myself reacting, negatively, positively. But I think in this, what you were saying is layers, like this sort of scale of, liking to really liking or not like something being unpleasant, you don't really, you just shrug it off.
Yeah.
And something that you feel you need to do something about because it's harmful or, it needs
to your fingertips. So I kind of wondered, you know, to do activities, to do something I haven't. At what point do you decide to do something when you do that?
And the question is, there can be things which are in the category of today unpleasant, which need to be attended to, need to be dealt with. And so, when do we decide to go from just being a quiet observer to being an actor, and to do something? And and there's no simple answer for that because there's so many different situations we find ourselves in. So we have to use our common sense. And we have to use our intelligence and understanding the situation and also our ability to understand what the consequences might be if we don't do it or if we do do it. And also it's very helpful to know, are we being reactive in the situation or are we being responsive? And so if we're reactive, if we can avoid it, then it's best not to be reactive. Reactive means you're being a compulsion to act a certain way. But you're not free in how you act. And hopefully the mindfulness practice teaches us how to react, be compulsive, not reactive, and instead learn how to respond wisely. And as we respond, we get information back, we get feedback back, and then we get push patients depending on what we learn. And yes, it's necessary to respond here, but I guess it was a mistake to use a sledgehammer. I think next time I'll bring a regular hammer. So this idea of feedback and evaluating it, using our common sense of learning from what's going on, is very important if we learn to know how to make those decisions if you're asking them. And the default, if all you do is ever listen to a Vipassana teacher, it would seem that the only thing you're allowed to ever do is just sit there quietly and observe. So that's kind of a fault for this kind of teaching, where so much of the teaching has to do with mindfulness, meditating on the cushion. Cushion's generally a pretty safe place not to react and act, just be present. And how that translates into daily life, that's a whole other question. And sometimes it's good to just observe and not do anything, and sometimes that's a disaster. Thank you.
I was thinking about what Mary had said, and I experienced a little of that, but then I realized very quickly that it's just that there is so much stimulus walking outside that there's a lot coming in which to discern pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And it's actually, to me, it's like a learning the layers of subtlety. So the gross experience may be that overall it feels like nothing's happening. But if you look closely or if you're quiet enough in the mind, then you can see, oh, there's an element of unpleasantness in walking on a hard surface versus walking on a soft surface. But we don't always pay attention at that level in daily life, and that's where it becomes the elements of being able to discern that, because that's happening at a low level and all of a sudden it builds up to where we become reactive to something that we didn't realize happened at that low level.
Some people can live pretty disconnected from what's out there around, so they can really take it in, the sensations and feelings. Also, sometimes people are looking too hard. We're looking for the details. And sometimes what we're reacting to is the overall mood of the event, the situation, the overall configuration of the thing. And the whole grand picture is unpleasant. And that's what we're reacting to for whatever reason. And so if we're trying to be mindful and pay attention to the subtlety of the details, everything, that we're missing the big picture. Sometimes it's a big picture that we're reacting to. And sometimes we're reacting to the small details. So we have to kind of be sensitive to know back and forth, to know where's the reaction for it. And what's the pleasant or unpleasant? So sometimes the big picture is unpleasant, even though elements within it might be pleasant. So one more. Do you have a question? I'd like to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
I may have gotten the assignment a little bit wrong or different, at least. I was thinking that we needed to associate the breath with present and present. So I was thinking of often just noticing my breath, but I had never noticed before. I don't know what to do with this, but it was to be interesting. I stumble a lot, I have a balance disability, but pretty much a light gets in my eyes or the light changes, I'll stumble a little bit. And every time I stumbled, my breath changed. I've never noticed that. And that's been going on for 15 years. I found that interesting. And maybe there are all kinds of things that are just slightly unpleasant when my breath changes, and I'm not aware of it. It would get touchy with the breath, but I wasn't bothered at all. I was fine. Just how I left.
It sounds great to notice the thing of the breathing, and to notice the different habits of the breathing. Maybe it is a way of working with your breath to help you keep your breath. Okay, so I'd like to read to you this, the tetra, the four points. So it starts off, each of these is called a training. So one trains oneself, this way. One trains oneself, I will breathe in experiencing joy. One trains oneself, I will breathe out experiencing joy. One trains oneself, I will breathe in experiencing pleasure. It could also be translated as happiness. One trains oneself, I'll breathe out, experiencing pleasure. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, experiencing the mental formations. One trains oneself, I will breathe out, experiencing mental formations. One trains oneself, I will breathe in, calming the mental formations. One trains oneself, I will breathe out, calming the mental formations. That's the fourth. So I'll start with the third one. I will breathe in, experiencing the mental formation. Again, this is the word of sankhara. And sankhara has to do with the volitional, usually has to do with the volitional side of our experience. That which is what the mind does with things. Motivations, thought, ideas, thoughts, desires, whatever. Or it's that part of the experience that is affected. It's somehow affected by the mental psychology reaction to what's happening. So the bodily formation is either the whole way the body is shaped or is experienced. The effect on the body that a mental life has. The mental sankhara could be seen as the effect on the mind to what the mental activity has. So if you're really angry a lot, then maybe the mind feels really tightened up into a tight little ball. And so that sense of being contracted is the effect of the sankhara, the mental sankhara of anger. Now, in the elsewhere in the discourses in the Buddha, mental formation is said to be the veda, the feeling form of experience. So the feeling tone experience is placed in the category of the mind, not in the category of the body. So we might think that a feeling tone is something inherent in, like my knee hurts, that's inherent in the knee. And the pain belongs to the knee. But according to this Buddhist psychology, that experience of unpleasant pain is put in the category of the mind. And that, I think, is really interesting. And I think both modern physiologists, research is a finding is that even intense pain sometimes is a composite event that has many subjective elements that are part of it. And some of the, if you change some of the subjective elements, the feeling of the pain can change quite dramatically. And the classic example is that someone who's in pain until they get to the doctor and get the diagnosis. And when they get the diagnosis, they can relax with, I'm safe. I'm not fear the way it might be. It's settled, and somehow the fear dissipates and the human pain is not so bad. So the Buddha puts its webinar in the mental category. And so again, it slides over to this more subjective side of things. And that's why I think a few people, Vipassana people, sometimes define vedana as liking and not liking. In my mind, that goes too far, objective realm. But there's an overlap, there's a relationship between them. And so the mental formation can be seen as the both the subjective, all the subjective aspects that has to do with the feeling thing. So the feeling from itself, the evaluation goes into it, and also it has to do with our response and reaction to the feeling thing. So if something is pleasant, you can feel the desire to have it. And if it's unpleasant, you can feel the desire to push it away. So so as we become aware of this whole universe of feeling tone and the relationship to it and towards it and creating it and reacting to it and all that, we're training ourselves to become aware of it. As we become aware of that, then we can do the last step right here, which is we can relax the mental realm. We can relax the subjective problem, the evaluation, the judgment, the reactions, the for and against, the liking and disliking. That can all just calm down. Calm down. Okay. So you go off and you feel, you're standing and sitting in traffic, and you're late for something. And it's really unpleasant. And you really have a strong dislike and unpleasant to it. And you can get wrapped up in your thoughts and your anxiety and your hurry and your patience. Or you can just feel, this is unpleasant. And relax. Everything else but the unpleasant. Okay, this is unpleasant. And then kind of soften and relax. So it talks here about being a trainer to do this. And this is a different training than how mindfulness is normally taught here in the West at the school of life. Normally it's taught, just pay attention to what's going on without any effort, any attempt to change what's going on. Just be present. If it's unpleasant, just be aware it's unpleasant. If you're having a reaction to it, just be aware that you're having a reaction to it. Just trust the knowing. Trust the learning. Enough just to know. Things will change in its own way if you stay with the knowing. Stay with the learning. If you stay with the knowing, then itself will show you that place where you find your independence, your freedom from what is known. But here, in this instruction, you're not told to flee from belonging, just belong and knowing. You're also told to get involved. And the way you're told to get involved is to calm the mental formation, calm the whole inner world of reactivity, reactivity and activity that goes on in relationship to the mental field. Now, it has to be done carefully, because if there's too much sense of control, I'm the one in charge, and expectation is supposed to be because I have to be successful, you can knock yourself in the mouth. And so sometimes this kind of training is done best after a person has learned the non-reactive, accepting kind of mindfulness first, and learn how to be present for things without needing them to be changed. Once you have some sense of doing that, then it can be quite healthy. You don't be stuck to health and love. It can be quite healthy sometimes, easy enough, and looking at the allowing things to calm down, settle down, feel you're agitated, and so you have to calm down, relax, settle down. So, and then it brings us to the first two parts of the spectrum. We're going backwards. And the first one says, one trains oneself to experience joy. And this is usually taken as being to train oneself in concentration practice. As we get more concentrated, more absorbed in the breath, then sooner or later, feeling experiences of joy begin bubbling up. And we talk about this last night. Joy can be called intense, quite strong, sometimes it's called rapture, it's really intense. And it's a phenomenon of concentration. Partly it occurs because we're no longer caught up in the world. a normal reaction, normal concern in the world that you know that. And it's so nice to have the mind not caught up in hindrances in your life. And to get a sense of delight and happiness that they're not caught up in. As we get more concentrated and more settled, then there's a joy that arises out of the concentration itself. And perhaps if you're a physiologist, you would say that at some point there's something about the locking in, the focusing, that produces serotonin in your system. And serotonin tends to bring up a feeling of euphoria, well-being, if something happens in your body. I kind of don't like this kind of explanation because it's kind of reductionistic somehow. I kind of, at least like a third, you know, that somehow is more... something to do with the whole mental culture and mental development that's going on. But in any case, this joy, as we talked about last month, can be quite strong. And the encouragement here is to train to have this happen. And it's quite common in Theravada Buddhism for some lineages of meditation practice to really emphasize developing strong concentration so you develop strong joy. And some people take it one step further, and to develop a strong concentration that goes beyond joy into what's called sukha. And sukha is usually translated as happiness. However, I translate here as pleasure, as to some other perspective, because it's generally seen as belonging to the world of pleasure and pain, and connected to the two. And it's not, has nothing to do with, it has very little to do with evaluation of the subjective experiences of the mind. Joy has to do with the mind, much more. And happiness is much more sublime and subtle, and something more, I think, deep, sublime, giving a pleasure in the body. But the pleasure kind of almost seems demeaning, the way of talking about it. Happiness is a kind of better translation in some ways. Anyway, it's a whole translation issue, which I don't want to get into. So as concentration deepens, so you get more absorbed into your breath, then there's experience of joy and happiness occur. The value of the joy and the happiness is twofold. First of all, not for its own sake, but because the mind is sufficiently calm and centered and stable enough that it can actually do some careful investigation. It can actually see much more carefully what's going on. And the second is that because we have a sense of well-being with that, sometimes it can be easier or significant to step back and look at the subjective way that we related to that joy and that happiness. To begin distinguishing, pulling ourselves back a little bit to find that place of independence. To study and see how do they relate? How do they relate? What's the subjective aspects, the world, subjective world, mental world, that arises in relationship to this intense joy and happiness? So, for example, there could be people who feel really attached to the joy. There could be people who feel that they wanted to savor it and linger in. People who want to feel self-congratulatory. This is great. You know, I did this. You know, there's all this kind of stuff that happens with that pleasure. But to kind of step back and do the mindfulness work and begin teasing apart the mind. The mind is not caught or enmeshed, entangled in that. Sometimes it's easier to be out of pleasure. And pleasurable sensations lead to unpleasant sensations. Sometimes it's harder. But because the mind is so concentrated, it says it's easier to do this kind of work. At least if you're trying to take this for a second tetra and understand it as being a progression, then we understand this progression into two strong states of concentration. And from this strong state of concentration, from there, we begin looking at the subjective aspect of what we call here mental formation. Subjective world of how we relate to the feeling tone of things, liking and not liking, preferring, not preferring, all that, holding on, pushing away. And as we do that, beginning to calm it down, ease it, lighten it. All the time, breathing. Breathing. All the time, breathing. The breath is a great lubricator. As long as you're with the breath, then all the other things you're doing, like calming the mind, calming the information, you're not going to be so caught up in it. It's not going to be such a big engineering project. You're not going to have so much at stake in it. It's just going to give you kind of a light touch to it. You're kind of doing this, you're kind of staying with the breath, breathing with the breath, breath keeping you soft, relaxed. And then you're aware also, oh, there's a pleasant experience here. This is when it feels unpleasant, it's fun. And here's my mind pushing away or judging it or something. There's this calmness as you breathe. Settle that, let's relax, soften. It's like we'll stay with the breath, let's keep soft, just relaxing, opening. The spreading of the mind, expanding of the mind. So in terms of feeling tone, classic Buddhism puts a lot of value on experiencing pleasant feeling tone. Pleasure and happiness. And this goes, those of you in the Sutta study class, this goes in a really a direct opposition to a lot of the ascetic practices of the time of the Buddha, where the idea was to experience a lot of suffering, self-inflicted suffering, ascetic suffering. And there was a belief among some people in ancient India that happiness came from suffering. That the more pain you can experience, the more you kind of purifying yourself, purging yourself, purifying yourself of all your bad karma. And you needed to kind of just really get in there and suffer a lot. So they would do, they would lay in beds of nails, or they would stand in one posture for 7 days without moving, or they would do all these ascetic practices as a way of kind of somehow suffering enough. So the more you suffer, the more you're finishing up all your old karma. And the Buddha came along and said, that's nonsense. And in fact, not only is it not true, but you don't have to be afraid of you don't have to be afraid of the kind of pleasure that arises out of meditation practice. Because the ascetic, there's a kind of anti-pleasure kind of attitude among these ascetics. And so anything that was a sensual pleasure, any kind of pleasure at all, was considered somehow bad or evil or something. And the Buddha came along and said, that's not the case. Buddha also seemed to have some sort of tremendous danger in sensual pleasure. But what he offered instead, which is something that offers a greater pleasure, is a pleasure that comes in deep meditation practice. And so, on one hand, sensuality in Buddhism is not encouraged, say it mildly, in tradition, but what's encouraged instead is a greater happiness, a greater pleasure. So Buddha was not just a party pooper, but rather he was a better party. So it's kind of interesting, that's the case. So some people take this as a progression, then you get into these deeper states of concentration, and then from there you begin doing this work of looking at your subjective activity, the mental activity, all around pleasant and unpleasant, liking and not liking what goes on. Another way of doing this, which is probably more realistic for most of you, most of us, is don't wait until you get into deep states of concentration, but rather be content with whatever sense of well-being you have when you sit and meditate or your daily life. But then begin training yourself to notice the whole world of the mental reactivity that goes on in relationship to pleasant and unpleasant and neutral. And then as you notice that and become more familiar with it, to begin settling it, relaxing it, letting go of it, letting the mind become more peaceful, non-reactive. Does that make some sense, what I'm saying? So do you have any questions about that? Yes, Madam.
That was really interesting. Thank you. And it reminded me of the Six Realms teaching.
Of what?
Of the Six Realms teaching.
Six Realms?
Six Realms.
Oh, Six Realms.
The Pretas, the Hell, the Animals, the Devas, the Asuras, and the people.
Yeah.
And the teaching that that the people realm is the only realm where a person can actually achieve liberation. That the bliss realms and the hell realms, you can't actually get liberated. And at first I was like, why can't you be liberated as a god? I mean, that makes no sense. But it's similar, I guess, to what you're saying, that the rapture isn't the final state, that a more chilled out kind of happiness is a more mature happiness than you know, an ecstatic sort of happiness that people sometimes get in concentration states.
Yes.
The two teachings seem resonant.
Yeah, I think so. So there's a the last time we met, because we were here, I talked about read about the similes, about teachings of the first three jhanas. Remember that? And the fourth one is the absorption. The first jhana has primarily characterized by the peace of equanimity, where there's neither pleasure or pain, neither sukha or dukkha. And so one way this progression works, if a person's doing this jhana practice, is that sukha, the happiness, also goes away. It's a much more satisfying experience of equanimity, where the mind is no longer caught up in the world of pleasure and pain at all, no longer even feeling it. So you see that the calming of the mental formation, the calming of the reactivity, takes the person's in the third jhana. The calming of the mental activity takes them into the fourth jhana, where that has this where there's no reactivity at all. There's no evaluation anymore at all of pleasant or unpleasant. Mm-hmm.
So I kind of have two questions. And the first one is about the idea of the Buddha says, well, bunk on, you know, suffering and burning through karma. And I was wondering if, you know, there's a certain kind of suffering that I think people and I experience, that not laying on a bed of nails and running out looking for problems, but actually encountering what's within. And there feels to be some purification that comes from allowing that.
Absolutely.
And so yeah, that's what I wanted to clarify there. And then the other thing is, I think I got a little lost at the end, though everything sounded really logical, and I just wanted to hear it again. The part where you said you don't necessarily wait for the deeper states of concentration, but just appreciate the states of well-being that arise, and then and noticing the whole pleasant, unpleasant experience, and then practicing to train to calm the mind. Would you just say a little bit more about the last part there? What would that
so be? As you're practicing, one approach to practice is to become sensitive, become aware of the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect of the experience, and the mental the world of mental reactivity in relationship to that. Some of that reactivity is the evaluation that goes into evaluating as pleasant and unpleasant. And some of it is the mental reactivity in response to the pleasant and unpleasant. So before and after kind of thing. So you become aware of that. And, to feel something pleasant. And then to notice that the mind then starts planning how to get that. And so there's this response, this reaction to it. Or there's something unpleasant and anger wells up. You're angry. So he starts noticing the world of mental reactivity in relationship to this, the feeling tone. And once you get really familiar, aware of, sensitive to the reactive mind, then it's also okay to begin letting go of it, to relax it, to soften it. And so the fourth training here is to calm the mental world, that mental reactivity world.
And of course, when you said that at the beginning of your discussion, my question was, well, how does one do that? You know, I know breathing is a great start, but are there other guidelines?
Yeah. So let's sit.
just breathe.